Shrink Wrap Radio number 509, The Naturopathic Approach to Psychiatric Problems with Jennifer Barr, ND.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jennifer Barr, ND. She's president-elect of the California Naturopathic Doctors Association and an expert in natural medicine for the treatment of mental health conditions, with a particular interest in mood disorders and child and adolescent behavioral issues. For more information about Dr. Jennifer Barr, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Transgenerational Trauma, Development of a Neurobiological Therapeutic Tool by Cassandra Garmston. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, here's the interview. Jennifer Barr, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. And you are a naturopath, and I've had a couple of other naturopathic guests in the past, but we'll just pretend like I never talked to them at all. So let's let's have you start out by telling us just what is naturopathic medicine.
Okay. Well, I'm actually really glad that you asked this. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm actually the president of the California Naturopathic Doctors Association. And this is something I have to share with people frequently, is there is actually a large difference, especially here in California, between a naturopath and a naturopathic doctor.
So a naturopathic, really?
Huh. Yeah, there is. So a naturopathic doctor such as myself and the two that you have worked with before, we're trained in four-year postgraduate naturopathic medical schools that are comparable to that of an MD or a DO. We really focus on integrative medicine. So it's the same sort of basic biomedical sciences as your conventional doctor learns, the same biochemistry, the same anatomy, et cetera, even the same pharmacology. But what where we really differ is that we focus from the very get-go on integrative medicine. So using natural therapies, diet and lifestyle, botanical medicines, homeopathic medicines, nutritional medicine, et cetera, as a primary intervention rather than going to the pharmaceuticals first. And the way that that really differs from a naturopath is somebody who went to an online program, especially here in California. We don't have what's called title protection. Mm-hmm. And so somebody can call themselves a naturopath even if they have no formal training, no practice on actual patients, haven't taken national licensing exams, aren't, you know, regulated by the state, et cetera. So there's actually quite a big difference.
Wow, that's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate for somebody like you who's gone and gotten all this training and worked really hard to get credentialed and licensed and everything, and then to have that kind of confusion in the marketplace. That's not good.
Right. And it causes confusion for legislators, but it also causes confusion for patients. People will go and see what they think is a trained doctor, and what they're actually seeing is somebody who went to an online unaccredited program.
Yeah. Delving a little bit more into the extensive training that you've had, tell us about your pre-med background. Did you take the same set of courses, say, that somebody who is studying to be a traditional physician takes?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my pre-med training was in physiology and neurobiology. I went to the University of Maryland. All of my colleagues who I was going to school with were going to conventional medical school, and that was actually my plan too. I intended to go to conventional medical school until I had my own issues that came up and started to be really aware that the traditional conventional medical route didn't have all of the answers. It had some answers, definitely. And so My conventional, my prerequisite training did include the same organic chemistry, biology, all the, those really intense details that you would do if you were going to be a conventional doctor as well.
And was that ever a consideration for you? Did you ever think that you might want to be a conventional doctor? Did it ever cross your mind, geez, I've taken all these courses, I could be a conventional doctor?
Yeah, and that was always the plan, actually. And to be really interesting, I didn't even find out that naturopathic medicine existed as a profession until I was taking my MCATs and applying to conventional medical school. So I'd finally come to that realization that what I could do is I could go to conventional medical school and then take additional training to learn more of the things that we don't learn in medical school, the more natural approaches, so that I could practice in a integrative way. And it was by complete accident that I found a naturopathic doctor, an article written by a naturopathic doctor that I didn't even think was a real thing until I Googled it. And then I found the school that I ended up going to, which was Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine. So all along, the intention was to become a conventional physician.
Mm-hmm.
It was when I found out that this course already existed, that was basically, I had already synthesized everything I was trying to do on my own.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand that you were recently in Washington, D.C., advocating for the practice of naturopathic medicine. What can you tell us about that? What were you trying to get done there?
So every year, our national association holds what's called the D.C. Federal Legislative Initiative, which is our federal lobby day. I've been 8 years in a row now. This was my eighth time visiting. This year, we were talking about trying to start what's called a demonstration project in Medicare. So this project would basically be to study the efficacy of naturopathic physicians being included in Medicare, specifically for chronic disease of cardiovascular origin. And so it's basically to try and get the wheels moving, because we know, we've done a lot of studies, we've got a lot of evidence that naturopathic medicine actually helps in many chronic diseases, including cardiovascular disease. But as I'm sure most people are aware, anything that requires adding another provider type to a system, people just see a lot of dollar signs and they want to make sure that there's validity to it actually saving money. So this would be a project to show that.
Yeah. A long time ago, psychology struggled with those issues, you know, vis-a-vis the medical establishment and psychiatry. And, right. You know, and finally, psychology elbowed their way in, our way in. And then came the master's level people, counselors and so on. And they had to kind of struggle and elbow their way in. And it's a continuing thing. Now, I think you alluded to the fact that you've had in the past some mental health issues of your own. And is that something you could share with us here?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty open about it. It took me quite some time and some really good therapists to get to the point that I was willing to be open about it and comfortable talking about it. But ultimately, it's really the background for why I do everything that I do. You know, my job is not easy, my work is not easy, but I'm really passionate and committed to it because of my own experiences and what I've seen others go through. So my family does have a lot of mental health conditions and that they struggle with. Me personally, when I was 16, my mom had me go see a psychiatrist and a psychologist because she was concerned that I was maybe depressed because I was coming home and sleeping for hours and hours and hours, not wanting to do the things that I was normally wanting to do, crying a lot, and just sort of not feeling like myself. You know, I was the president of the National Honor Society and on dance teams, and I'd quit all the dance teams, and I was getting my first ever D's in my life, and things just weren't going so well. So she made me go see a doctor, and they gave me some medication. They gave me an antidepressant, and the unfortunate thing is that the antidepressant actually skyrocketed me through the roof, through the stratosphere even, because it turned out that...
In what way? Did it make you hypomanic or something like that?
It did. So it was unfortunate that I didn't have the awareness, my mother didn't have the awareness, and the psychiatrist, you know, whatever, took my word for it, or I was just stubborn enough that I stopped seeing the psychiatrist, and I was able to talk my mom out of making me go. But yes, the antidepressant made me hypomanic, and I obviously didn't know much about it at that time. I was 16, so I was like, oh, I feel great. I don't need to sleep at all now. I'm the life of the party again. This is wonderful. So I took myself off of the medication and stopped going to see the doctor because I was like, I don't have a problem anymore. Let's stop. And then several years, a lot of ups and downs for about the next 8 years between my time in the military and my going to school full-time, which I did together. So I had a lot of stress going on. Yeah. Arabic linguist in the military during Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, and going to University of Maryland full time. So a lot of stress. Finally, the stress got to me enough that I ended up feeling really, really depressed again. And to be perfectly honest, it was the first time in my life that I felt truly suicidal. And so I was smart enough to get help, despite the fact that in the military at the time, there was a strong belief that if you asked for help, especially psychiatric or psychological help, that you would lose your security clearance and lose your job. At that point, I realized that if I didn't get help, I'd lose my life. So losing my job didn't really make that much of a difference.
Yeah.
And so I did go in to see the doctor. They got me in quickly because I had been actively suicidal for a few days. And they took their time. They were actually able to get the right diagnosis. And so they got me on to lithium for bipolar disorder, which is the diagnosis that I ended up, I'm technically a disabled veteran now for bipolar disorder because it was diagnosed while I was in the Navy and my service made my condition worse. And so still had a lot of ups and downs and issues with the diagnosis and the treatment and the way that the treatment made me feel and my acceptance of the diagnosis. And so
it was a hard diagnosis for you to accept.
It was. I feel like it's hard for a lot of people. I work with a lot of people now who have bipolar disorder. And I think the hardest thing is that I was told that when I felt my best, when I felt like I was really me, I was actually sick. And that, you know, I was going in for help because of the depression. And then I was told that you at your best is actually somebody who's sick. And that didn't work very well for me. It didn't, it hurt, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Now, did they use the word sick? Or was that a label that you were putting on it?
It's been so long. I'm trying to recall. And my doctor, I do remember he told me that I was lucky. I think he may have said the word sick. He told me I was lucky that I was sick because if I wasn't, I wouldn't have been able to get really high grades while I was going to school full time, studying a really hard course of study, basically pre-med, while I was active duty and fighting two wars. So he basically said that I owed it to my illness that I was successful in my ventures that I was undertaking.
Wow. I'm sure you're aware that there is a movement among people who suffer from bipolar, or maybe suffer is the wrong word, I don't know, but kind of an activist movement that resists a lot of that labeling, is my impression.
Yes.
I had students when I was teaching at the university who seemed to kind of brag that they were bipolar.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to brag about it because I don't think it's necessarily something to brag about because it's definitely given me a lot of challenges in my life. Fortunately, through the effective use of naturopathic medicine, I no longer have the medications that I have to take, and I've actually been very stable without any episodes for multiple years now. So I actually do think that I've recovered from it. But I'm always on the high alert that it could show up at some point, and I just need to be aware of it. Part of that movement that you mentioned is one reason I finally decided to share my story. It was through work with the International Bipolar Foundation and the National Alliance for Mental Illness that I started getting that courage to share my story. That because a lot of people that I met through those organizations felt almost defeated, that they had this permanent lifelong illness. They were never going to be able to accomplish anything with their lives unless they were going to be artists or something. You know, that's always what's referenced is the artistic and the creativity with a manic episode, or like the suffering from depression can fuel that sort of artistic fire. But it's what gave me the courage to finally talk about it. And to be honest, because in all honesty, I was able to realize that a lot of people, you know, talking about cardiovascular disease earlier, people are able and easily able to talk about the fact that they have heart disease or they have diabetes, which are diseases that people live themselves into. You know, lifestyle creates a lot of these things. And bipolar disorder, I didn't do anything to create. I was a clean kid. I didn't had never had a drink of alcohol, no drugs, nothing. And this came to me. And so I needed to stop blaming myself for it and stop doing it.
And the interesting thing, too, is that there were gifts that came with it.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And I'm able to share that with my patients a lot now that are still struggling, that there's a lot of really great things. I personally think that any mental health condition has an adaptive reason that it exists and persists. Mm-hmm. And that bipolar disorder, I know that I've seen the world in ways that other people haven't, with a lot more acutely, a lot more vibrantly. And now in a very stable place where I don't see those vibrant colors. I don't have those ups and downs and those challenges. I can now relate to my patients and understand what they experience in a way that I couldn't get from a textbook. And so I think that that's the gift that I now have from having had this experience in the past.
Yeah. And you've kind of specialized in mental health issues in your own practice. I assume, is that an outgrowth of your own personal experience?
It truly is. I realized that from my own experience between doctors basically telling me I was going to be sick for the rest of my life, and some did say sick for the rest of my life. I didn't have not all my doctors were the best doctors. I had some amazing doctors, but some less supportive. And then the one in particular that sticks out that really challenged me, that led to me practicing the way that I do and having the specialized practice that I do, was when I saw a psychiatrist when I was in my late 20s, and I was talking to this doctor about what I would need to do if I ever wanted to get pregnant. And he told me that if I ever wanted to get pregnant, I would have to get ECT or shock therapy. Because,
that sounds bizarre.
Right? No, he told me that that's the only way that he could believe that I would not harm the baby and that I would be safe. And the thing is, I wasn't even that sick. You know, I'd never been hospitalized. I'd managed every single time I had an episode to stay out of the hospital. And this doctor told me my only option to have a child was to get ECT. And at this point I was in medical school. And so I was like, I knew that would destroy my brain. I've seen people who've had ECT. They've got really significant memory issues. And sometimes it's the miracle cure and sometimes it doesn't help much. And so I was like, that's an awfully risky thing to consider just so that I can, you know, be healthy enough to have a baby. And so I was willing to give homeopathic medicine actually a try. That's when I first was willing to consider the homeopathic medicine as a viable option, if for no other reason than because nothing else, or if it didn't work, then I could always go back to the conventional medications. And fortunately, it was the most powerful medicine I've ever experienced in my life. And it really is truly responsible for transforming my life. And that's why I actually practice the way that I practice now. And that devotion that I have to my patients and to the practice of naturopathic medicine for psychiatric conditions is because I still work with a psychiatrist. I still check in twice a year with my psychiatrist just to make sure, you know, nobody's a perfect judge of themselves. And whenever I go in, if I'm having a little bit of a low day, my psychiatrist's first question is it time to go back on lithium? Instead of, are you taking care of yourself? What's going on in your life? How are you eating? What sort of stressors are you having in your relationship?
So those are the questions you would ask
in your work
of your own patients. Those are the
questions. What's that?
I say those are the questions that you would ask of your own patients.
Exactly. And this isn't being asked of me. And it reminds me, I think it's actually a good reminder that I still work with a psychiatrist personally. It reminds me of what my patients are having to experience in their own healthcare. And so I've lived in a bubble for so long, in this naturopathic bubble, that I'm used to people having these sort of conversations, these more in-depth conversations about the whole person. And so I forget that a lot of people don't get that from their conventional psychiatric.
So did you see a naturopath yourself? Is that how you got into the homeopathy? And the related question is, how did you even hear about homeopathy to try it, to even consider that it might be helpful?
So I did see a naturopathic doctor when I was for all of my treatment. I don't treat myself. I don't think anybody should ever treat themselves. We're not good judges of ourselves, right? So when I first found out about homeopathy, naturopathic medicine was that story where I stumbled across it while I was studying for my MCATs, where it tied all the natural therapies with the conventional therapies. It was actually at a naturopathic medical conference focused on psychiatric conditions that I met the doctor who I decided to finally see. And he specialized in treating bipolar disorder at the time. He's since moved on and treating more of schizophrenia now, but he was really focused a lot on bipolar disorder at the time. And he seemed to get it. And unfortunately, he did primarily do homeopathic medicine, which to me, as somebody who is a scientist, my background is in physiology and neurobiology, homeopathy didn't make sense to me. So for those who aren't familiar, if you're not familiar with homeopathic medicine, it's actually the prescription of single substances that are found in nature that are prepared in a very dilute way that are prescribed based off of unique characteristic symptoms. So symptoms that are not based off of the diagnosis, but based off of a unique presentation of a diagnosis. So when I first started naturopathic medical school is when I learned about homeopathy. I had my very first course. And when I found out that it was using these dilute substances, it made no sense to me. And the scientist in me almost quit naturopathic medical school.
Okay. That's where I am. I have to confess that I wouldn't be honest if I didn't tell you that I'm stuck in that skeptical place that you were for a while. So if you can do anything to help me bridge that gap, that would be good. It seems to me that it was a system maybe that was developed in the 1800s or something like that?
Late 17, early 1800s.
Okay, so before we had a lot of the science that we have today. So I'm not even sure. I don't know enough of the history to know who thought it up and all of that. But it was kind of, in a way, pre-science, but pre-modern science.
Right.
So help me, and also what I want to know, aside from anecdotal experiences such as your own, has there subsequently been any science to support it?
Of course. So I'll start with my own experience with my skepticism, because, I came in to naturopathic medical school, and I was being taught this system of medicine that gives such dilute substances that there's basically none of the original substance left in it, which is what homeopathic medicine is. And so, of course, I was how am I ever going to use this? This is nonsense. It made me call into question the entire program, to be perfectly honest. The fact that it was a required course, how could the required course of a legitimate program be teaching something like this?
And so I
definitely called into question everything about what I did. It was through that desperation that I had, where I was ECT or homeopathy was the option that I was basically faced with, because a lot of the substances that we can use, the other natural substances, there's a lot of really effective things for anxiety, for depression, but not as much that I've seen to be really truly effective for bipolar disorder, for mood disorders or psychotic disorders that aren't also still potentially damaging to a child, to an infant. And I was hoping to try and find something that could help my body to heal rather than just replace a drug with a natural substance. Because, I mean, lithium is a natural substance too. And so it was that desperation that made me give it a try.
We have to mention that, to me, the one big plus on the homeopathic side is it's so dilute that there's no way that I would assume that there's no way that it could be harmful. But on the other hand, if it can be helpful, couldn't it also possibly be harmful?
So you would think so, but it's the way that the exact way that it works right now is still being studied. And so I can understand where you're coming from. And I still, to be perfectly honest, I'm still a skeptic of it myself too, except for what I see day in and day out in my practice, people who nothing else is helping are getting better. By using the homeopathic medicine, and that's it. So I know that it works. I know that it works. I don't understand exactly how it works. And so I don't believe that it is unscientific. I believe that it is science we don't understand yet. The studies that have been shown to try and elucidate, Iris Bell is a medical doctor in Arizona. She's doing a lot of studies to try and actually determine the mechanism of action for it. And she's found through some of her studies that there are nanoparticles created in the formation and the process of actually producing it. And so that it may be related in nanoparticles. People always bring up quantum physics as something. I don't really understand quantum physics at all. I don't know if that's where the answer lies. All I know is that there are studies that are showing more and more how something works. And if you think about it, yes, this came about in the 1700s or 1800s, and it was better than what was given at the time. At that time, that was when people were doing bloodlettings and mercury and arsenic in high doses to try and help people get better. So homeopathy was definitely a plus in that. I would say with some of the medications that we're using today, that homeopathy is also a plus, because a lot of these medications, my patients are coming in, they may have their manic episodes more under control, but now they have metabolic syndrome or diabetes because the medications cause so many other symptoms as well. It's causing cardiovascular disease in people. It's causing diabetes, et cetera. So in some ways, I would say that we're still similarly treating people with a medication or a substance that causes another issue. With homeopathic medicines, it is beneficial, but it doesn't. I don't see side effects. I don't see the negative implications for people. A lot of people will say then that homeopathy is merely placebo. There have been studies that have been shown, and I'd be happy to send you a few of them, that showed that homeopathy was better than placebo in cases including ADHD and depression. There's been studies shown against comparing it to Prozac and show that it was no less effective than Prozac, which, to be perfectly honest, for those of us who are familiar with the studies, know that Prozac is barely better than placebo itself. So it's not necessarily a shining star for homeopathy, and I understand and respect that. The difference being that the conventional medications such as Prozac, with this one particular example, forces biochemistry in the body and therefore causes other things to occur in the body, which we call side effects, but are really just unwanted effects of the substance.
Yeah.
Whereas homeopathy doesn't do it. And so even if it were placebo, that's sort of where I've landed. Even if it is placebo, even if it's 100% placebo, if people are getting better and their body is healing and they're not having side effects, they're not having cardiovascular disease and diabetes as a follow-on from it, then I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I am too, as a matter of fact. I know that for a long time, placebo was kind of a bad word. But, you know, it may be that you are performing a sort of shamanism, if you will, right? A set of rituals and routines and so on that in a particular subset of our culture is taken as meaningful. And we know that people, you know, in other cultures where shamans are the doctors, and they do get good results for some things, we're told. And so if it's all placebo, as you say, I don't think that's a bad thing. If people are getting better.
Right.
And that's really the bottom line. And then the other...
And
do send me some articles, by the way.
Of course.
And the other thing I wanted to say is I think a lot of the medications that are used, the regular medications, are very blunt instruments. I've been interviewing a lot of people about neuroscience and the brain, and so I'm getting kind of more sensitive to the complexity of what goes on in the brain. And there are substances, endogenous substances secreted by the brain that I think are very minute in terms of the quantity of those, whether they be hormones or neurotransmitters or whatever, and yet they can have powerful effects. You know, if they're not there, if there's too little, there's too much, it can have powerful effects on a person's experience and on their behavior. And and then the other point I want to make, and then I'll give it back to you, the interviewee, is that it's been surprising to learn that how many of the psychotropic medications were discovered kind of accidentally. They were used for something else, and then they sort of, you know, for some physical problem. And then they discover, oh, we can also repurpose this to be a little bit of a psychiatric thing.
Exactly. So that was actually one of the points that I was going to make. So first I want to touch on, well, I'll touch on that since you were right there. Yeah, a lot of those medications, the first antipsychotic was actually meant to be a chemical lobotomy. And so because they were able to know the mechanism of action, they knew that Thorazine blocked dopamine. So they then made the assumption that schizophrenia was an excess of dopamine instead of finding out that schizophrenia was an excess of dopamine and then looking for something to block it. So it was backwards. It was bedside to bench instead of bench to bedside. So there, the use for it, and there is definitely validity to the way that neurotransmitters impact the, our mood and our functioning. But I think that we put more faith in that than we should, because it's also very different personal variations of what your neurotransmitter balance should be, and what works best for some people, right? Yeah. That's why for people who have depression, but it's a bipolar depression, if you try to make serotonin stick around longer using an SSRI, you have what happens to me, you become manic. And so the balance is very, very individualized, which is one reason that I struggle sometimes. I do use other therapies aside from homeopathy. Homeopathy is just everybody in my practice gets a homeopathic medicine. And then we do other therapies based off of what's needed for the individual. But back to the, before we talk about anything like that, I wanted to just address the placebo response, because I have had to come to that place for myself that even if it is 100% placebo, even if we can prove someday that all that's happening here is placebo, if we manage to figure that out, I'll be fine with that as long as people are getting better. Because that's ultimately my goal, is to help people get better and to help them get better with as little harm or as little force as possible. However, anecdotally, and this is definitely anecdotally, I don't believe that homeopathy is placebo because of my dog. So my dog actually has a, she has a chronic physical condition. She has what's called Cushing's disease, and in a dog that makes her actually have really bad urinary incontinence. And the doctors told me 2 years ago that she had, actually over 2 years ago now, that she had 2 years left and that she was basically going to be incontinent for the rest of her life. And we could just give her these medications that would give her all sorts of side effects. So I was stubborn, as I tend to be, and I gave her some homeopathic medicine. It took me 6 different medicines before I got one that actually worked. So no improvement at all with the first 5. And then with the 6th, suddenly my dog goes from having 7 to 10 accidents a day to none for months at a time. Wow. And then every time that she has an accident, I need to make a change to the preparation of the homeopathic medicine, and she stops having accidents. So I don't believe that it's placebo, because I've got physical evidence, not just mood-based, because I know in my practice, moods, a lot of things contribute to moods. But my dog has a physical condition, and she's a dog. Dogs are not really susceptible to placebo. And if it was just placebo, if it was like owner instilled placebo on her, the first one would have worked, because I really wanted her to get better with the first one. Instead, it took 6. So completely anecdotal, but that's what gives me, and to be perfectly honest, my husband, who is still very skeptical, finally accepted that homeopathy was a valuable tool at the very least because of what he witnessed with our dog.
So, are there, that makes me wonder if there are homeopathic vets.
There are. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, so I mean, again, anecdotal, but it gives me the confidence and the hope that before I die, that we'll have figured out the exact mechanism of action. And I think that we will. I think that we will. And we'll go back and look at this conversation and be like, oh, that was silly that we thought it was placebo.
Okay, well, you're a good spokesman for it, I must say. But I'm sure you didn't want to talk just about homeopathy in this interview. So tell us about some of the other approaches that you're using as well, and what kind of results you've been getting. Maybe you've got a case study or two that you would want to share with us. The ball's in your court.
All right. Well, so I do have like a systematic approach that I take with all of my patients. It's the first step is to remove obstacles. So anything that's in the way of healing, this could be, you know, diet and lifestyle is almost always circumstances related to removing obstacles to healing. So helping people, I'm sure the other naturopathic doctors, I've listened to the other naturopathic doctor interviews, they've talked a lot about diet and lifestyle. And then the second is to actually stimulate the body to heal, and that can be through the use of homeopathic medicine, or it can be then in addition to that, utilizing like the third step basically is to utilize things that are targeted based off of the individual's needs. And so the type of medicine that I'm the most interested in aside from homeopathy is genomic medicine. And I'm still...
Say that again.
genomic medicine. So what genomic medicine does is it actually takes a look at your genetic code and looks at the way certain enzymes are functioning that help to up or down regulate neurotransmitters, the production of neurotransmitters, the clearance of neurotransmitters, etc. So MTHFR is a really big one that people are talking about a lot these days. So it's MTHFR. It stands for methyl tetrahydrofolinate reductase. And so it's an enzyme that changes the way that your body processes from folic acid to folate. And then folate is needed for what's called methylation that then helps to produce many neurotransmitters, including serotonin. And so there's a lot of people who have anxiety or depression that struggle with this, and if their body's not able to appropriately process this B vitamin, their body's not going to be able to appropriately produce these follow-on neurotransmitters. And so identifying those sort of things in people is really, really helpful. The one that I'm really interested in the most these days, probably because I have this defect and I'm sort of curious to see how many of my bipolar by patients who've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder have this defect as well, is COMT and MAO. And so those stand for catechol-O-methyltransferase and monoamine oxidase. And so these are enzymes that actually help to break down what's called excitatory neurotransmitters. So the epinephrine, norepinephrine, et cetera. So these are the chemicals that when you are flooded with them, you're in fight or flight mode. So a lot of times they call people who have these defects that I happen to have the perfect warrior, because it makes you able to be hyper alert, hyper attentive, not need a lot of sleep, have a lot of energy, things that can seem like a manic episode, right?
Yeah.
So I've been doing a lot more studying with those and using specific nutrients to try and help manipulate their functioning or bypass functioning if necessary.
Are you, I wasn't clear if, what was it? MTFO? Was that it?
MTHR.
Say MTHR?
MTHFR.
FR. Even the initials are too hard for me, let alone say the whole word. Is that a pill? Is that a dropper? What is, and where does it come from?
So that's an enzyme that's in your body that helps. So what an enzyme does is it helps to make one substance into another, catalyze the transformation of one thing into another thing.
So are you giving them something to activate that process, or approaching it just in terms of nutrients, or, you know, how are you making your intervention?
Yeah, so generally if somebody is not expressing that gene, I will give them something to bypass it. So if we were to use, you know, making coffee as an example, the coffee maker is the enzyme that gets you from beans or ground beans to actual coffee, right?
Okay.
So you need to have coffee and you need to have the water and you need to have the coffee maker to put them together to create coffee itself. And so if for some reason your coffee maker is broken, you've got to do something to either make it work better or change it or replace it. So with our body, what we have to do is we just bypass it. So it's like if your coffee maker is broken, instead of trying to fix the coffee maker in the morning, you just go to Starbucks and you just get your coffee. So what we do is we just replace it with a nutrient. And then so it's methylated folate that it's replaced with. There is some evidence that homeopathic medicine can actually help and work on the epigenetic level as well. And so that means, you know, if we've got 97% of our genes at any point are turned off, only 3% are actively functioning. So just because you have a gene for something doesn't mean it's going to be expressed. This comes up again and again, especially related to cancer these days. There's a lot of women, Angelina Jolie is a good example. She got the genetic test and found that she had the gene for breast cancer. And so she decided to have a preemptive mastectomy. And so, but the challenge is that just because she has the gene doesn't mean that she is absolutely going to get cancer. There's a lot of things that go into the proliferation of cancer and turning these genes on so that it can function. The same thing is true with homeopathy, that it actually can help turn on and off genes, just like your diet and your lifestyle, where you live, stress factors can turn on and off genes. Homeopathy helps work on all of those things as well together. And so I've been trying to look more, and I'm still in the early stages of this. So hopefully I'll get a chance to talk to you again in a few years, and I can have more information about this particular overlap with these two. But I have seen people who have, myself included, these genes that say that I should be wired and on fire all the time and never sleeping, actually calm down and function more effectively. And so it's a multiple array that I'm trying to take with these things. I'm trying to do both the nutritional support to help the body function better, and then bypass as well.
Well, what about the role of supplements? I know that's another tool that you use. And we hear such mixed things about supplements and vitamins and so on that it's useless to take them, that you just urinate them away, and yet it's a huge industry. Yes. Most of us are taking supplements.
So supplements, I think, can play an important role. I tend to try and use, in my practice, I tend to try and use as few as possible, just because I'd rather have people eating to get their nutrients than taking supplements. However, our soil is not as rich as it was once upon a time. So the level of nutrients that we get from our spinach, from our broccoli, from our carrots, et cetera, is not what it was 20, even, you know, 50 years ago. They're in many ways, they're also overly pesticide ridden. Mm-hmm. And so that also will change the way that your body absorbs, because it changes your inflammation in your body. It changes so many ways that your body can actually interact with those nutrients. And so I do sometimes provide supplements for my patients, specific targeted nutrients based off of what I found in their genetic testing. Or if there happen to be, like many of my patients who come to me are quite sick actually, and they've not been taking care of themselves for quite some time, sometimes I'll give them a broad spectrum multivitamin, as well as a probiotic to help with assimilation of those nutrients in a more effective way, so that they can just restore those basic levels that they need for the appropriate production of neurotransmitters and hormones that are responsible for making sure that they have well-managed and stable moods. I sometimes will use supplements in other formats. I think I told you this, I actually recently launched a supplement company myself. We only have a single supplement, but we use it as a tool. The name of the supplement company is Natural Mental Health Supplements, and we have a single supplement that was something that I felt was really necessary, because I saw this with my patients a lot, is they are on antidepressants and they're not feeling quite as depressed as they were. Sometimes they're even feeling remarkably better. But then they got other side effects that come on. You know, the common ones that we always hear from antidepressants are the sexual side effects, the weight gain, and then the insomnia are the main things that we see. And so I've got a lot of patients, you know, as a naturopathic doctor, despite the fact that people always think naturopathic doctors, and especially somebody who does homeopathy, is very anti-conventional medication or anti-pharmaceuticals, I am not. I think that, as you said, they're blunt tools, but they can be life-saving tools. And I do use them in my practice when they're necessary. And so sometimes people do really remarkably well on the antidepressants, and it makes the most sense and it will do the least harm to keep them on those medications. So I wanted to give them something they could actually take to help reduce those impacts and make it more, make it easier, basically, for them to stay on the medications. And so that is a supplement that I will use in my practice now, as well as the Antidepressant Companion is the name of the supplement that I created that replaces the nutrients that are lost from the chronic use of an antidepressant, as well as works. It has some specific nutrients and then herbal medicines as well that help with the side effects and have been studied to be effective in conjunction with antidepressants to reduce the side effects. And that also happened to have the double whammy of having been studied as standalone for depression, so that in most cases can actually help to reduce the amount of antidepressant that's needed, so therefore also reduces the side effects from that second approach.
Okay, and kind of in passing, you just mentioned two other things, probiotics on one hand and herbs on the other. So maybe you could expound on those two a bit as other tools that are in your armamentarium.
So probiotics are really, really important for any mental health condition. There have been a lot of studies, and I'd be happy to send those to you as well if you would like to see those. A lot of studies that have shown that the gut flora and its function have actually impacted the way that people experience mental health conditions. And so if they've got what's called dysbiosis or dysregulation of their gut flora, where it's out of balance, then one, you're not going to assimilate nutrients as well. Your gut flora are actually responsible for making some nutrients. And so you'll have less production of some of these nutrients. And then you're basically not assimilating your food effectively enough, and the nutrients from the food. And so restoring these appropriate balance of the gut flora is really helpful for regulation of depression and anxiety as well. There's a lot of studies that are coming out that are suggesting that, I'm sure you've heard of leaky gut because everybody talks about leaky gut these days. There are some studies that are suggesting that there's actually leaky brain as well that can occur as a result of inflammation, similar to what happens in the gut. And so what's getting across the gut into the bloodstream will then eventually get into the brain and cause more inflammation there, which, again, inflammation is highly correlated with depression and anxiety and basically every psychiatric condition.
Yeah, we're hearing a lot about inflammation these days as well. A lot about probiotics, inflammation.
Yes.
And what about herbs?
So the herbs, I use them sparingly in my practice, aside from the ones that I use when somebody's goal is to stay on an antidepressant, they're happy on the antidepressant, I'm happy with them on the antidepressant, then I'll use them to help with these side effects. Herbs are basically crude forms of drugs. So a lot of drugs that we use have their roots from herbs. And so these herbs are, to be honest, I think that they're effective when you're using them as a drug, but oftentimes they're less effective than the drug itself. So if I have the choice between an herb or a drug, I'll have this conversation with my patient. I generally recommend the drug, which is surprising for a lot of people to hear. But I generally recommend the drug because it's generally more powerful and you don't have to take quite as much of it. And they're really well studied. The herbs are well studied too, but not to the same extent because you can't patent an herb. And so there's not as much studies that have been done on them. So when I use an herb, it's usually as what I call a Band-Aid to try and help people make a transition to a better way of life, or to help them through a circumstance that they're facing. People have situational anxiety. I'll use an herbal supplement as an herbal Xanax, if you will, because that is a drug that I won't recommend, the benzodiazepines. So I'll use an herb in those sort of circumstances.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. If a naturopathic doctor wants to practice in mental health, kind of as you have, where would they go to get their training? And it brings to mind, it sounds like you've listened to my interviews with other naturopaths. Mm-hmm. And so I'm blocking on his name, but the one here in the Bay Area who's gone on to get psychoanalytic training. So that's one way to
Dr.
go.
Dr. Stephen Ducott.
Yeah, you got it. Stephen Ducott, right. So what would you recommend to anybody who's either a ND already or thinking of going that direction and thinking that they might want to specialize, as you have, in mental health?
So the good news is I was fortunate and I was actually able to do a mental health focused residency that I actually helped to create myself in a private practice. We are working. This is the really good news is we actually recently founded, and Stephen Ducott is actually on the board with me. We recently founded the Psychiatric Association for Naturopathic Physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our goals is to provide better continuing education for doctors who are hoping to do more psychiatric-based care, to actually provide a test so that people can actually have like an identifier so people can know if they're going to see a doctor for a psychiatric illness, that they know that this is a doctor who has passed the board exams for the Psychiatric Association for Naturopathic Physicians, as well as creating more residencies. So hopefully in the near future, we'll have a lot more that we can offer specifically as a naturopathic approach to psychiatric conditions. For now, the best thing that people actually can do is to work with the people who have done their own research and done their own expertise or built their expertise, such as Dr. Ducat has, such as all of the people who were on the board with me for the Psychiatric Association of Naturopathic Physicians. We've gone above and beyond to seek out additional training. So, you know, for the homeopathic training for myself, I did a residency that had a large focus in that, as well as additional training with one of the greatest living homeopaths, Andre Sain, in Montreal, as well as doing the nutrient-based side, doing a lot of work with Dr. Ben Lynch, who does a lot of work with genomic medicine, as well as Dr. Paul Anderson. And then the Integrative Medicine for Mental Health group does an annual conference that does a lot of the nutrient-based and like gut-based focus for mental health. And so right now, it's funny because I went into naturopathic medicine because I wanted to not have to cobble things together as a conventional physician. And it turns out with having this interest and this focus on psychiatric training, on psychiatric specialization, I have had to cobble together a little bit of these things. But yeah, we're hopeful in the near future that we'll have a very, very clear course that people could take.
And as you're probably aware, I've done a few interviews with integrative psychiatrists. Is that the right word? Integrative?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Have you been able to, is there communication between the two groups? Mm-hmm. Is there mutual respect? Is there competition? What's the deal there?
Yeah, there is a lot of integration. I'm sure that in some circumstances there's competition because there always is, but, in my personal practice, I actually work with several integrative psychiatrists that we cross-refer. Especially, interestingly enough, this one in particular sends me all of his tough cases that when he's not able to get the nutrient therapy. And part of the problem is that when somebody's really not doing well, it's harder to get the diet and lifestyle changes to get them into a place where they can start, you know, doing better and potentially weaning off of their medication if that is their goal. And almost always it's their goal. So a lot of times I will get those referrals from him to get people feeling well enough that they can take more responsibility for themselves, to sort of take the edge off of the manic episode or the depression, the anxiety, the psychotic episode, if you will. And then we do work collaboratively because I've got the expertise in the homeopathic treatment. I can do all of the other things that he does, but he, you know, I'm happy to hand that off to him as well. And so we do work really well collaboratively in that sort of realm.
Okay. Well, you're based in the San Diego, California area. And I'm wondering, do you do any, can you help people remotely via Skype, or do you do any kinds of consultations, virtual consultations in that way?
I do. It's a case-by-case basis. So I do have some patients that I'm able to work with remotely. Always it's better if I can meet somebody in person. Sure. Skype has made that a little bit easier because I get to see a little bit more of their mannerisms and symptoms that I might miss otherwise. But I absolutely can work with people remotely, again, case-by-case basis. So I do a free consultation with everybody before they start up with me, just to make sure I'm likely to be able to help them, and then to make that assessment whether it's a wise thing to do for me and for the patient to work remotely.
Okay, so would your website be the best way to find out more about your work and to contact you if somebody was interested in that?
Absolutely, and my website is drjenniferbahr.com. That's drjenniferbahr.com.
Okay, well, Dr. Jennifer Bahr, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. Been enlightening for me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'll make sure I get those studies about homeopathy to you.
Okay, thanks.
Dr. Dave, it's Rob Canora. I apologize for not calling sooner, but I did want to take the time to encourage you to continue your podcast. Love listening on a regular basis, and to encourage all your listeners who have not already to take the time to make what should be a one-time donation if you've only listened to one podcast. But if you're a regular listener like me, I encourage you to make an ongoing donation to support your continuing efforts and all the time and effort, obviously, that you put into to delivering such a wonderful regular update on all things psychological. Thanks again for your hard work, and keep it up.
Thank you, Rob, for that reminder and encouragement for me to keep it up, which I'm certainly doing my best to do. And I'm happy to report that we do have two new donors. My sincere thanks go out to Francis Lynch and to Kane Spooner. I'm also happy to announce that we have a bunch of new transcripts thanks to our wonderful listeners / volunteers. We have number 507, Imaginal Figures in Everyday Life with Mary Harrell, PhD. We have number 506, Exploring the Medicinal and Spiritual Potential of Marijuana with Barbara Harris. Number 500, Enhancing Your Baby's Development Through Movement with Beverly Stokes. Number 503, Exploring the Disease Model Debate with Professor Peter Kinderman. And finally, number 466, Yoga Therapy for Addiction, Depression, and Anxiety with Sarah Joy Marsh. So thanks again to our transcriber volunteers, and contact me if you'd like to join them. As I've mentioned before, I do already have more than 100 CE units through the Zur Institute. And recall that I've just added a banner ad in the left-hand sidebar reminding all you professionals that you can get 10% off on all the APA continuing education materials at the Zur Institute, not just the courses based on my interviews. And those CE courses count also for social workers, nurses, counselors, and probably some other professional categories that aren't immediately coming to mind. Now, you can click on that banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on our site, or simply go to zurinstitute.com, search through their extensive catalog, and then use my discount code at checkout, which is DrDave88. That's DrDave88. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, I'd like to share with you the wonderful audiobook I'm currently enjoying. The title is Switched On by John Elder Robison, and it's even read by the author himself. John is on the high end of the autism spectrum, having been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome numerous times. He took part in a series of experimental treatments using TMS, which stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation. There have been several past interviews in which TMS was referenced as a cutting-edge treatment that's being explored for a number of conditions. I believe the research John describes is the first focusing on individuals with Asperger's. The impact on John was very dramatic, among other things, opening for the first time empathic abilities to read other people's faces and voices and meanings in a way he'd never experienced previously. I heard him interviewed by Terry Gross on NPR's Fresh Air and knew I wanted to get the book. Fortunately, it's available on audible.com. I'd very much like to interview him as well, and have written to his publisher. But whether or not that happens, you really should get this book, and I think hearing it in his own voice adds a whole other dimension. Let me play you a sample.
There I was, doing 75 miles an hour in the left lane on the Massachusetts Turnpike. Suddenly, without any warning, I found myself transported back to a Boston nightclub circa 1984. It was 8 p.m. on April 15th, 2008, when everything changed as I switched on my car stereo. I was 50 years old, half deaf from hanging out with rock and roll bands in my youth, and tired from a long day working on cars. On top of that, I'd just left Boston's Beth Israel Hospital, where a team of Harvard neuroscientists had run an experiment on me using high-powered magnetic fields in an attempt to rewire my brain and change my emotional intelligence. I've always been weak in that area because I have autism. Some autistic people have trouble talking or understanding language. Others, like me, generally talk fine and listen some of the time, but we often miss the unspoken cues, body language, tone of voice, and subtleties of expression that make up such a big part of human conversation. I've always had a hard time with that. Luckily, my social disability is offset somewhat by my technical skills. But many of the gifts that helped me make a living and take care of myself today also left me feeling lonely and broken as a kid. Some vestige of that hurt has remained in me, and that was why I had agreed to join the scientists on what several of my friends had called a crazy quest. The idea of fixing myself with a fancy new treatment had sounded great in theory, but from what I had seen so far, it hadn't worked. The scientists had proposed using electromagnets to rearrange connections in my head. It had seemed like science fiction, and maybe that's all it ever would be. As I got into my car that evening after 4 hours at the hospital, I was more exhausted and annoyed than when I'd arrived. But otherwise, as far as I could tell, nothing had changed. The drive to Boston had taken 2 hours, and now I was facing another 2 hours to get home. What was I doing there, I asked myself. But I knew the answer. I had volunteered for this research study because the scientists had issued a call for autistic adults, and I wanted to make myself better in some ill-defined but powerfully felt way. Those thoughts and 1,000 others were all running through my head when I plugged in my iPod and music filled the car. I'd done that same thing 1,000 times before and heard nothing more than songs on a car stereo. I hadn't seen anything at all, just the road ahead. This time, the result was strikingly different. All of a sudden, I wasn't in my car. I wasn't even in my body. All my senses had gone back in time, and I stood backstage listening to the Tavares brothers singing soul music in a dark, smoky club. Years ago, I'd stood by those stages as the sound engineer, whose job was to make sure the machinery of the show kept running.
And from there, I can tell you he had a spectacularly dramatic experience. But if you want to hear about that, you're going to need to get the book. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they now have more than 250,000 titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dr. Jeffrey Raff, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jungian analyst Jeffrey Raff. You can listen to my two interviews with Dr. Raff on episode number 290, Ally Work with Jungian analyst Jeffrey Raff, PhD, and number 303, Exploring Synchronicity with Jungian analyst Dr. Jeffrey Raff. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Dr. Jennifer Lutz, who writes, Hi, David. I learned of your podcast through the APA website. It's been a while, but I think I Googled psychology podcasts and your site came up. I consider myself a group geek, so there are several names I would throw out, but I will start with Dr. Martin Whittingham, my mentor in grad school. He's the chief of clinical integration and research with Mercy Health in Ohio. He developed a brief model, focus brief group therapy, of doing process-oriented group work and integrates the interpersonal circumplex in a pretty dynamic manner. He is incredibly knowledgeable about the field of group work and is also very well connected within the group world and could make some excellent recommendations for further interviews and put you in touch with any of the folks below. Cheryl L. Marmarash has actually written a book on attachment theory and group work. Phil Flores has done some interesting work on addiction as an attachment disorder. Malin Lesses co-authored fifth edition of Yalom's Theory and Practice of Group Psychotherapy. Gary Burlingame is a prolific researcher in the area of group. She goes on to say elsewhere, I have paid special attention to the attachment focus episodes because of my personal interests and have also been fascinated by the work of the neuropsychologists you featured. And that's in part from Jennifer Lotz, postdoctoral counselor fellow at Sonoma State University. And actually, she was writing in reply to an email exchange that we had where she suggested I interview people involved in process-oriented group work. And so I asked her for some recommendations, and you just heard them. So hopefully we might get to one or two of those on my very extensive request list at some point. And next we hear once again from Yusel. I'm sure I'm messing up his last name mightily, or his first name rather, in Istanbul again, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, episode number 503 with Professor Peter Kinderman was thought-provoking. His views got me thinking on the limitations of the reductionist approach to explaining human existence. Why do we insist on this approach anyway? Our persistence is akin to a phobia that limits our thinking. Let me see where this will take us. We can see what happens in the brain when I see a red-colored shirt. Nonetheless, seeing does not mean knowing exactly what is going on. To know exactly what is going on, I must know what is going on in the smallest, quotes, thing that makes in my brain. What is the smallest thing? What happens in it when I see a red shirt? Unless I answer this question, I do not really know what's going on. Why can't we simply imagine an existence model where all that exists is a continuum? In this model, a red shirt is a different manifestation of this one than a green shirt. Anne Bering certainly seems to suggest this kind of a model in her interview with you earlier this year. The harder we try to reduce consciousness into physical components, the more we get egg on our face. What is wrong with suggesting that energy is all that exists? And I'm going to drop off from reading his rather long email at this point, which with his permission, he said I could stop reading it out loud at this point. So once again, that was from Yusel. And Yusel, thanks for your observations on the limitations of reductionist thinking. And I certainly agree with the point that you're making. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. As always, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, naturopathic Dr. Jennifer Barr, for sharing her journey around natural medicine. My next interview will be with psychologist and author Dr. Arthur Janov. If you're old enough to have been around in 1970, perhaps you remember his very provocative book of that year, The Primal Scream, The Cure for Neuroses. That certainly was a strong claim and one I intend to ask him about. So I hope you'll join us then. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.